Just check to make sure that everything is working right here. It looks like it is. Yeah, we're picking it up, all right. And let me just get my notes out. And let me begin by indicating that today is January 26th, 1995. And this is Jim Boning speaking with Edward Donnelly in Bel Air, Florida, just outside of
Clearwater.
I know that you were born in Highland Park, Michigan on the 26th of November, 1921. Could you tell me a little bit about your father and mother and your family background?
Well, my father and mother came from farm communities in Michigan. And my father worked in Detroit for a few years in the 20s, before the Depression. Then when the Depression came, we moved, left Detroit. He was unemployed and settled on a family farm that had been in my father's family for several generations. And we lived there throughout the Depression and until I went away to college in 1939. My father and mother had both been in their youth school teachers. In those days, they had what they called normal schools in Michigan and in other states, where a person could go to these schools for 2 years and get a teacher's, I don't know what it was called, a teacher's certificate or something like that, which made them eligible to teach in the public schools. And both of them did that for a few years. But then from the beginning of the Depression on, my dad and all of us went back to the business that he'd been in when he was a child, and his father before him, of working the land on the farm.
Mm-hmm. And where did you receive your very early schooling?
I went to the local schools there. In the grade school, I went to it was called the Pledgett School. It was in that area. In those times, they had a one-room schoolhouses dotted around the countryside. They were separated by about 2 or 3 miles. The one that was whose district we lived in was about a mile and a half from where we lived, and I went to that school. And I'm very active in education reform now. I think there's a lot to be said for the old one-room schoolhouse with one teacher and 8 grades in the school. It was just had one room, and instead of the teacher, is the conventional practice now, standing and lecturing to a class of kids all the same age. These kids learn from each other. Mm-hmm. And it was there was a real sense of community in that little school room. So, but anyway, that's what I did. And then when I went to high school, I went to a local small high school. When I graduated, there were 8 kids in my graduating class.
And the high school was where then?
That was in a town. Well, the town has since disappeared. It was the name of the town was Lenox. But it was just a little small community, and it's now doesn't exist anymore. It's been incorporated in a somewhat larger town called Richmond.
Richmond, okay.
And that's in Macomb County in Michigan.
You were the oldest of 6 children?
8 children.
8 children?
Yeah.
Okay. It must have been difficult times with the Depression living off the land, as you say.
Well, it was difficult, and we were poor. But everybody was poor. This is a house that was built by my great-grandfather in the 1850s, and that's where we lived. That still exists. We still own the land around it, and pay the taxes and rent the land. Our Inez and my three children and our other, their equivalent from the other branches of our family, treat this old house now as kind of a shrine.
I can imagine, yes.
Because our family lived there for 100 years.
It's incredible.
Of course, the ones who think it's wonderful to preserve that shrine, not the generation that presently pay the taxes.
Is it pretty much growing up around there now?
No, it's still pretty rural.
Still pretty rural.
Yeah. That's at the north end of the county. And the industrialization is at the south end of the county. That's in the school, congressional district represented by Mr. Bonnier, the Democratic whip in the House now. When my great-grandfather came there in 1850, came in 1848, I think the house was built in 1850. It was on the edge of civilization, really. And he bought the land and worked it, and then his son did, and then his son, my father, did, and we did when we were children. Mm.
When you got to high school, had you given any thought as to what you wanted to do beyond that? Besides farming?
Yeah, my mother and father, my mother in particular, but my father too, always talked about the university. When I look back on it now, I don't know what university they meant. I guess they meant the University of Michigan. But it was just a foregone conclusion that our family, myself and my brothers and sister, would go to the university. When I finished high school, I didn't have any idea how to go to the university, and we didn't have high school counselors or anything. In fact, nobody in the high school that I went to, that rural high school, I don't think anyone had ever gone to college. Nobody in my class of eight students did. And I hitchhiked out to Ann Arbor one day when I was about 16 and talked to the people there. And it just was no way to... I could get a job in an old hotel there, but it just wasn't enough. I couldn't put the thing together for the tuition and so forth, even in a state university. And then, to my dismay, I found out that the high school that I was just about to graduate from was not accredited by the University of Michigan. So I gave up that idea, and I went to try to get a job, and there weren't any jobs. And my father didn't want me to stay on the farm. He wanted me to go and do something different. And so I joined the CCC, the thing that the Roosevelt administration...
Civilian Conservation Corps.
Yeah. And I was sent to a place in northern Michigan, and it was run by the Army in those days. And the commanding officer of the place I was a Major Hambleton. You going somewhere now?
I'm off to get my hair done.
Oh, okay.
It's a weekly ritual.
See you later.
Good to see you and have a productive meeting.
Thank you.
He took me out of the field forces where they were planting trees and so forth, and made me his clerk in the office. And so I had I didn't really have much to do there. And so I spent a lot of time writing letters to colleges, every place I could think of. And I'd had all A's in my high school transcript. And so finally, late that summer, I got a letter from Lawrence Tech inviting me to come to school there and offering free tuition semester by semester as long as I maintained a B-plus average. So I was in Detroit, and I had confidence that I could get some kind of part-time work in Detroit. Mm-hmm. So I went down there and went to school, got a job at, as I knew I thought I could, I did get a job at Sears Roebuck and worked there in evenings and Saturdays and had the free tuition. And so I, 4 years later, I got my engineering degree.
Were there dormitories on campus, or did you live in a rooming house?
Rooming houses, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Lawrence Tech has gone. I just retired from that board. I was chairman there for many years, and Lloyd Royce, the former president of General Motors, has been on the board a long time. He's chairman now, and we have a new president. But the college, now called the university, has a history parallel to Air Products, and I played a comparable role, I guess, in both of these institutions. When I went to Lawrence Tech, it was a new school which had been created in 1932 or 3 by the Dr. Lawrence, who had been dean of engineering at the University of Detroit and had some conflict with the management there. And it had at that, when I went there, it had 300 or 400 students, and it was operated from rented facilities. Now today, 50 odd years later, it's on a really striking modernistic campus in Southfield outside of Detroit. Has 6,000 students, mm-hmm. And it's got a very limited endowment, unfortunately, but it came from just a little seed into a really very significant institution.
Wilkes College started in 1933, and that's a very unusual time to be starting an educational institution in the depth of the Depression.
Yeah. Well, I'm jumping around, but before I got my degree, I was working on various things. Some courses I took in the evening, some courses I took in the day, and I had different kinds of jobs. And I got a job then at Air Products in the spring of 1943, before I got my degree in June, and I worked part-time at Air Products, got paid 70 cents an hour. But it was a new company. It had I think it was 10 employees, but the records aren't clear anymore, but it was a very small number of employees, and so...
Was this in Detroit, or the Detroit area?
Yeah, it was in Detroit at that time. And so I had a marvelous experience of seeing and participating in Lawrence Tech growing from a very questionable whether it would survive type of school into a well-established institution, and Air Products the same thing.
You said Lawrence Tech had about 400 when you went there. What was the faculty like, and did it emphasize engineering?
Yeah, the faculty in that time were mostly colleagues of associates of Dr. Lawrence, who, as I said, had been dean at University of Detroit. And there were, maybe a half a dozen permanent faculty. A relative of Dr. Lawrence was the administrative officer who ran the administration, and most of the other faculty were what we would now call adjunct professors who were in the engineering department at Ford or Chrysler or General Motors mostly, and came there and taught a few courses.
Mechanical engineering was the thrust That was the emphasis?
Yeah, mechanical, well, and architecture. Today, the university produces mostly undergraduate degrees, but give a smattering of master's degrees in business and engineering and architecture. But it's still a small target school with those disciplines, and they existed then. Engineering and architecture were the predominant curricula even back in those days. And architecture there then and still means mostly industrial architecture, so that graduates of that school of architecture generally get jobs in big companies or architectural firms doing work for industrial manufacturing companies and things of that sort. There was for many years, and while I was there too, a degree in chemical engineering, but that's not the course I took. I took the course in mechanical engineering.
Was there any reason why you selected mechanical engineering?
I think that I felt that I could master that easier than chemical engineering because the high school education that I had, I had never had a course in chemistry or I mean, it just wasn't a very advanced high school.
Mathematics, was that a strong point in your background?
Not in high school. And in college, I really had a tough time with math because I had to preserve this B plus average or I lost my scholarship. And it was hard for me to, because there were a lot of kids in the Lawrence Tech in those days who'd gone to really good high schools, like Cass Technical High School in Detroit, for example, was preeminent. And I don't remember what level of mathematics they had, but I had never had a course in algebra even until I got in college. And I remember, boy, differential equations put fear in my heart.
The war was going on.
The war was going on. The war started, of course, in 39 and then in 41 when the United States got in. And I was deferred from military service while I was in the undergraduate school. And then I tried, at one time I was overcome with a patriotic fever and I tried to enlist in the officer training school in the Air Force. And it was discovered that I had a mild heart murmur. That was fairly early in the war where that was a knockout as far as an officer training school was concerned. So I just went back to school and stuck to it. And then by the time I got into my senior year and the Army and the military, all the services were really drafting people that would not have been eligible in the early part of the war. But by then I was working at Air Products and we had these military contracts and resulted in me not being drafted.
When you had this first job with Air Products before you graduated from Lawrence, what were you doing? What was your assignment?
I was doing mechanical drafting. I was taking quite a few morning classes then, and I would come to an Air Products office was near the school, a mile away. And I would come to the company at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and the company only had 2 or 3 engineers at that time, maybe 4, and they were working on these designs mostly for the military, and so they'd have design layouts, and then I would take and start making the detailed drawings on the drafting board, and I could stay there as long as I wanted until 8, 9 o'clock at night and get paid my 70 cents an hour. And so that's what I did. And then in June of that year, which was 1943, I got the degree. And it's a degree called, there were two alternatives in degrees, and nobody outside the campus knew the difference between them or even cared. One was a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering, and the other was Bachelor of Mechanical Engineering. The difference between the two was that to get a Bachelor of Mechanical Engineering, you had to do a project and a research and write on it. And on the campus, the mechanical engineering degree was considered much more significant than a Bachelor of Science degree. So I went for that degree, and I set up an experiment to measure the heat transfer coefficient on heat exchangers, which related to what I was doing at Air Products. And so I had to intertwine afternoons and evenings at Air Products with conducting my research project as well.
How many students graduated with you?
I would say it was about 60.
Mm-hmm. Had the war taken a number of students away?
Well, as time went on, the war did take a number of students away, yeah. And so in the class of 43, as I recall, had, I think, about 60. The class of 44 had maybe 20 or something like that, and I've forgotten the subsequent years it started to build up. And then the company moved to Tennessee. We were there during the war. Then when the war ended, we moved to Pennsylvania. And it was probably about 1950 or something. Dr. Lawrence had died. His younger brother was president of college. And he asked me to join the board of trustees, which I did. And then after a few years, I became chairman. And I continued that activity all the years I was at Air Products until last year, 1994. Before I became emeritus chairman, and the other guy became chairman.
So you were chair 45 years or so, something like that?
No, I must be off on, I think it was 25 years, so I must be off on a date somehow. It was, I was on the board for some years before I became chair.
Okay, so you were on the board 45 years or
something
so.
Like that, yeah.
Was it preordained you go to Air Products when you got your degree?
No. I didn't know where I would go. And I hadn't even heard of Air Products. And I met Leonard Poole. He was always interested in engineers and engineering. He wasn't trained as an engineer, but he had an intuitive judgment about engineering and about technology. And particularly the commercial side of marketing technology. And he used to come over there on the campus and talk to professors and students. And I met him, and I've forgotten exactly the details, but somehow came to be offered a job working part-time at Air Products first, and then later full-time. And the company had, you might be interested in this briefly, the war was going on, and the German Air Force was bombing London, and the British were making the initial bombing raids over Germany, and of course American, U.S., it was Army Air Corps in those days. U.S. Air officers were observing those things. And if you recall, the first Royal Air Force bombing over Germany was devastating to the British. The Germans had anti-aircraft guns that knocked them out of the sky. And it became clear that that in order to carry out operations of this kind, that the aircraft would have to get at very high altitude. And that meant they had to have oxygen for the pilot breathing. And the concept on which Air Products had been created was that rather than producing oxygen in large central industrial gas plants and delivering them to users, that for large users you could develop a miniaturized plant and extract oxygen from the air on site and pipe it into the steel mill or whatever. Leonard Poole had, with Carl Anderson, had started the company based on developing that concept, and we're working on it, and we're undercapitalized and really we're broke. The military, it was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, let out an inquiry for developing a portable unit for extracting oxygen from the air that would be of such size it could be transported by air to air bases around the world. And there were several large corporations who bid on that, an Air Products bid, but Air Products had already been working on the idea for commercial purposes and more quickly than anybody else, and that's when I came to work the first time when I worked part-time, that was just getting underway, and developed what became a successful U.S. government-accepted model. And then the government wanted hundreds of these built in Detroit. If you can believe it or not, now Detroit had negative unemployment in those days, so the government had set up a factory in Chattanooga, which they intended originally to manufacture tanks, so they sent Air Products to Chattanooga, and we only had I think 19 people who went there and moved into this partially completed factory and started manufacturing these things and did that on till the end of the war.
What was your role in that process?
Well, my role at the beginning was as a detail design draftsman, and then of course the company was expanding at an enormous rate. As I said, when I came in 43, it had like a dozen employees, and by the end of the war it had approaching 1,000. Mm. And so I was in charge of the engineering, and in charge of the engineering department, and then we were building these units for all of the Allied governments, for the British, the Russians, the Belgians, etc. And when the war ended, immediately those contracts were all canceled, and that was a stunning blow to the company, which hadn't really made any profit during the war, because the excess profit taxes and the renegotiations of the contracts and the facilities we owned and even the working capital was provided by the government, so the company didn't prosper financially by the war, and that was proper, you know. But the company did get a lot of technical know-how, And then the, but it was a stunning blow. The company survival was really questionable. I went with another group for 2 or 3 years. We had the company that had made the engines for the plants we were building during the war, Continental Aviation, which doesn't exist anymore, it's part of Teledyne now, had contracts to bring over from Germany all kinds of equipment, including oxygen equipment and engines and compressors and the buzz bombs and so forth, and experiment with those German devices and write reports on technical characteristics which could be then available to American business and American military. So I did that for 2 or 3 years. In the meantime, the company didn't want to stay in Chattanooga. Tennessee was a depressed part of the country in those days. It shows how much Detroit was prosperous and Tennessee was impoverished, the reverse of now. But it appeared that the principal market for the original concept of producing oxygen to sell on site to large users was in the steel industry. So we found this place in Pennsylvania, and a used factory drew us to the particular site, and came there, and then began the recovery from the war. And then I came there in 1950, after being off on this other thing for 2 or 3 years, and was there ever since.
You said that the company had 1,000 employees at the end of the war. What happened to the workforce at that point when everything was cut back?
It was just all disbanded. And there were, I think, again, the company was back to around 20 people.
Hmm. So by the time you got to Pennsylvania, that was your workforce.
Yeah, right. And we were, in those early days in Pennsylvania, really a manufacturing company producing this equipment. And we didn't realize it when we came there, but this used factory we found was in Emmaus, in the heart of the so-called Pennsylvania Dutch country. And that was a very lucky, fortunate thing, because the Pennsylvania Dutch people are basically, I mean, they're the kind of people who believe in a day's work for a day's pay. And we had really, in that little small business starting up increment by increment, we had very reliable, conscientious workers available, factory workers.
What kind of interactions did you have with Leonard Poole in those very early days?
Well, it was very close interaction every hour, every day, and over the years, he was I think about 16 years older than I, and he didn't have any children. He was my mentor, and he treated me in some ways like a son. I resisted that. I didn't want to be his son, and but it was a very close working relationship in all the years that we were together until the time he died.
What was his management style like, specifically in that early time period when the company was just getting started?
Well, his management style was very appropriate for a company of that size. He supervised everything. He had his finger in everything, mm-hmm. and he worked hard and continuously, and nothing escaped him. Now, eventually, it came to the point when the company, when that sort of hands-on, personal, hour-by-hour management couldn't cope with the size of the company, and he recognized that. It was in those transitions that he began really to assign more responsibility to me, and I didn't know anything about management. I didn't have any any management experience either, but I think temperamentally I was more disposed to think about the organizational structure and assume and transferring responsibility to others and so forth than Leonard was.
I was going to ask.
And he wanted me to go off, and I did go off to the Harvard Business School for that 14 mm-hmm. weeks or whatever it is, where it was his hope that I would learn management skills, and I suppose I did learn some, but I think what I learned mostly on the job.
So it was his doing that you went to Harvard for
mm-hmm.
that program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was going to ask again in those early days whether how much responsibility you had, or did you have to check with Poole in making important decisions?
Yeah, well, in the early days, everybody had to check everything with Leonard Poole. But as time went on, he weighed people, and he came to really repose more responsibility in me than in most of the others. But I was always very sensitive about that, even until the time he died. I talked over with him important issues before establishing him as company policy. And years now, I'm jumping ahead, but years later, his wife, Dorothy, got cancer and had a long suffering period, died in the New York Sloan Kettering Hospital. And during the end of her illness for several months, he had an apartment in New York and stayed there with her. He was very devoted to her and didn't want to leave her alone. And I was in de facto running the company then, but I made a point of going and sitting down and talking over things with him frequently.
Wasn't there a period when his brother might have been the heir apparent?
Leonard and George's background was this. Their father had been a welder on a railroad, and they lived in Minneapolis. And their father died when they were very young. I think Leonard was 16. And the mother was left in an impoverished condition with, I believe, three boys and a sister, I think. I know there's a sister, four children, the oldest of whom was Leonard, who was 16. And he really assumed the role of the father and the breadwinner, and he got various kinds of jobs and supported them. And the next younger brother was George. Leonard eventually then ended up in Detroit working for one of the industrial gas companies. And then he got George, who was 7 or 8 years younger than he, a job in the same company. And they were both salesmen. And there, Leonard developed the idea that rather than producing this gas and hauling it to where it's going to be used to make it at the site, and George stayed, and he left and started Air Products and borrowed money from his wife's father and from everybody he could, and as I say, was almost bankrupt until the military came along. And then he encountered, this is an important thing not to forget, he encountered Carl Anderson, who just died 6 months ago, born in 1898, mm-hmm. and just died. But Andy, could I divert, because he's an important part of this.
Mm-hmm.
Andy was a... Andy's predecessor was a man, L.S. Toomey. L.S. Toomey was a graduate of Purdue University in probably 1900 or something like that. And when Toomey and Anderson used to tell me these stories when I was young, When Thomas Edison started the Edison Electric Lamp Company in Cleveland after they did the development work in New Jersey, and they discovered, as everybody now knows, that if you put a tungsten filament in an argon atmosphere, you could make the incandescent lamp. And the source of argon was from the old German Linde company in Munich. And I've forgotten what Toomey told me they had to pay for a cylinder of argon. I think it was $100. Mr. Edison hired young engineers, and he hired Toomey, and he said, your job is to design a unit to separate air and get argon so we can make our own. And Toomey didn't know anything about that, but he struggled along and had a couple engineers, and after a few years, they had a unit that extracted argon. And Mr. Edison had his argon, and then Toomey encountered another entrepreneurial guy who had the idea of using the know-how that they had developed to make oxygen. That's what the big industrial market was. So they formed a company called Gas Industries Company. It was located in Pittsburgh. And from the time of World War I through the 20s, they produced industrial gas plants, which they sold to various small entrepreneurs in cities all over the country to extract oxygen and pump it into cylinders and sell it to welding shops, things like that. And in 1920, when Anderson got his engineering degree at Purdue, Toomey got him to come into the Gas Industries Company. And he worked there all these years. Then the Depression came. There were nobody buying any oxygen plants at all. The company went really out of business. Didn't go in bankruptcy, but it just simply went out of business. Andy had all of those engineering drawings, all that experience. And when he and Leonard Poole met each other in 1941 or something like that, that was the key to Poole making this idea work, because Anderson knew how to do it. And so that's how Anderson came into the picture. And then to come back to your early point, then George came into the company about 1943, and there was, of course, a real brotherly affinity between George and Leonard. When the first public stock was sold in 1946, Reynolds and Company was the securities firm that sold the stock, and they really had financial control of the company. They had three directors, and they controlled it. And they had confidence in Leonard, but they didn't have confidence in George. And so Leonard had a big battle with those people. Eventually, they left the board, and then from then on, he had de facto control of the company. He aspired, and many people thought that that George should be his successor. But the company was growing ever more technological. The engineering was getting more sophisticated and complicated, and I was more or less looked upon as the engineering member of the team. Anderson was a great engineer, sat high. He was a great engineer in the old sense of a mechanical person who Andy always expected the management to decide what the engineers needed to do, and then if they decide what they want, we'll engineer it. Whereas I had for no reason, I guess just my personality, was kind of the management and the engineer in the same person. And as it became more complex from a technical standpoint, gradually Leonard, and in the meantime he had other outside directors on the board, moved toward me taking more and more responsibility, and that eventually led to becoming first the chief operating officer and then the chief executive officer.
One of the things that I'm not quite clear on, and that in those early days it may have not had any real significant meaning, but what positions, if we could call it that, that you started out in design work.
Yeah.
And then, let's say, until 1950, what different kinds of positions did you have?
Well, I was called engineer, and I was called engineering manager at one time. I was then in the 50s, I began to take a more active role in sales, and we had, by that time, three or four salesmen. And I said, I don't want to have the title salesman. I want to be sales engineer, because I can put a different. Mm-hmm. So I had the title sales engineer. And then I had the title, vice president of sales. And in 1959, I was made, given the title vice president and general manager, which was sort of like the chief operating officer.
Okay.
And then subsequently, I was executive vice president for a time, and then I was president. And when I was president, we didn't use the terms and like it's used now, chief executive officer and chief operating officer, but during those years, in using modern terminology, Leonard was the chief executive officer and I was the chief operating officer.
Okay. A few things that I've taken from the Out of Thin Air book might be interesting to comment on, and I'm going back now to 1952, which is, I guess, now you're a sales engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the military aspects. You're advocating that the military aspect should be turned into commercial. It could be a commercial advantage.
Yeah. Well, what happened in the development of the industrial gas industry, the on-site took a certain small market sector to supply large users, but all the rest of the vast industry was supplied by extracting oxygen, compressing it, putting in cylinders, and delivering it to customers. And that's very expensive because the cylinder weighs 15 times as much as the oxygen. And during the 20s or 30s, the one company, the Linde Division of Union Carbide, had developed the technology for producing liquid oxygen. And for the vast array of middle-sized customers, that was the most efficient way to serve them. But nobody had the cryogenic technology to know how to do that. And then in the we had learned somewhat from the German experience during World War II, because they were producing liquid oxygen for their rockets, and we had the benefit of that background. And it wasn't very helpful. The Germans didn't, surprisingly enough, didn't keep very good records. But we had a benefit of that background. And then, with the Cold War going on, it was decided that in the U.S. military that we would use liquid oxygen and hydrocarbon fuel for the ballistic missiles. And so that we were drawn back to the Defense Department, and that whereas before, during the war, we were going to produce 1 ton a day of oxygen, now they were talking 10, 100, 1,000, several thousand tons. And so we started bidding on telling the government, Air Force by this time, that what were their choices. They could buy liquid oxygen from the only American company that produced it was Linde. And Linde said, we'll supply all you need anywhere in the world, and just tell us what you want. And we couldn't compete with that because we didn't have any production capacity. Linde had had the benefit during World War II of, you remember Roosevelt had introduced rapid depreciation for government contractors during the war, so they were able to put in large amounts of capital and write it down and have written down capital at the end of the war. And Carbide was fabulously wealthy then because they had a monopoly in this product and they had low capital cost. And so we just sat down and designed liquid producing plants that we thought would work, but we never had built any, and made presentations in the government showing that if it was during the Eisenhower administration and Wilson of General Motors was Secretary of Defense. I remember one day being in his big office in a Pentagon with 100 officers around there and making a flip chart presentation. Boy, I was shaking all over. Showing that if they would put in the capital, that we could produce oxygen for liquid for the Air Force at a price that would get the cap, compared to the Lindy price, get the government capital back in less than a year. And so they made contracts with us to do that. And then we started building those liquid plants. They were primitive and energy inefficient by today's standards, but they were the best we could do. And we built on the West Coast and the Middle West at Cape Canaveral over here, the Kennedy Space Center, and elsewhere, these plants with government capital, and then we had operating contracts to operate them. Well, we were producing liquid oxygen on a scale that approached Union Carbide. And we said, oh boy, let's go in the commercial side. Well, there were some, and here's where George made an enormous contribution. There were some 60 of these small entrepreneurial industrial gas companies in Pittsburgh, and Cleveland, and Denver, and every principal city in the country, many of whom were using these old-fashioned gas plants that Anderson and the Gas Industries Company had made for them in the 1920s. And the cost of producing a 100 cubic feet was the standard unit of measurement of oxygen from those plants was around 25 cents. We were producing it in these government liquid plants for a nickel. So George set out, and we didn't have any money, and he didn't have much money, but he gave a little piece of cash and Air Products stock and acquired about 19 of these companies who had trucks and salesmen and so forth. And then we'd put in a new liquid producing plant based on the government know-how, and that made the company just go through a very high rate of growth and produce cash flow that permitted us to do other things.
You had no financial background as such at this point yet.
No.
And here you are in the Pentagon testifying before, presenting a case to Wilson. And
yeah.
How did you feel? You said you were nervous about it, but how did you develop this ability to deal with the financial side?
Leonard had an intuitive feeling for the overall structure of a business, and I think that growing up in my teens on a farm helped me with that. Now, mind you, the farm was very impoverished, but a farmer had to do everything. He had to produce, he had to maintain quality control, he had to sell, mm-hmm. he had to have the financing if he could buy a new tractor. And when I was in those days in Michigan, boys who lived on farms were allowed to get a driver's license when they were 14 years old. And so we had a few chickens on a farm. And I started gathering those eggs and taking them to the city. It was 40-odd miles to Detroit. and going door to door selling these eggs. Well, more than we could produce, so I started buying eggs from other farmers and candling them. I don't know if you know it, but candling is a method. I didn't know what to, I wouldn't even recognize the words then, but it was a quality control technique. And I had to get a car that I could deliver these things in, so I bought a second-hand car, and I debt financed it really by agreeing to give the owner a share of the profit from the eggs. Well, that all sounds, we were talking about nickels and dimes and dollars, but the principles were the same. And I think I learned from that experience when I was a boy.
That's very interesting. You don't. I've worked on farms, but I never thought about a farm in that sense that you've just described, but it's certainly very appropriate. You went to Europe, I think in 1954, somewhere in there, to examine a number of different gas-producing operations there, and eventually ended up in Air Products licensing ammonia production.
Yeah, what happened at that time was that the use of fertilizer on American farms was increasing, and in Europe they used massive amounts of nitrogen fertilizer compared to this country. But the demand, the growth in the ammonia business, which really took off here during World War II, when there were government plants for producing ammonia and ammonium nitrate for explosives based on the same kind of contracts that we eventually had. In fact, we our original contracts to build and operate under government contract the liquid oxygen plants for the defense were based on contract patterns that had been established during the war to produce ammonia for ammonium nitrate. And so then when the war ended, that ammonia capacity existed. Farms in this country began to use it more, and the demand grew. And in Europe, we knew that they purified coke oven gas to get the source of hydrogen for producing ammonia, and we saw a potential market for that, and so we went over there and looked at some plants in Germany and Britain and the Netherlands and Belgium, France, and eventually, after several months, entered into a contract with the Dutch state mines to get their know-how for doing that in the United States, and we began and we sold plants to a U.S. steel plant out in Utah and a couple places, but in the meantime that business didn't develop as we had thought it might develop, because the natural gas pipelines were being laid all over the country, and natural gas from the Texas and Louisiana Gulf Coast was reaching out every place, and the cost of reforming natural gas as a source of hydrogen for ammonia rendered the other business non-competitive. And so we didn't pursue that. And in the meantime, the Cold War had raised the opportunity for the liquid oxygen production, and that took up a lot of our attention. Then. But we were always dabbling around in hydrogen, and the hydrogen story grew out of that. It's, I think, an interesting story. Maybe it's in thin air. I'm not sure. At first, the U.S. military was operating these U-2 spy planes, remember, over the Soviet Union and elsewhere. And they were operating on conventional jet fuel, and they could operate up to an altitude of 25,000 feet or something. And the American military knew that the Soviet anti-aircraft capability was improving, and so they made the Air Force made a very secret development program with the Skunk Works out at Lockheed. I got this book. I've only read a little bit of it so far. They were to develop. It was clear that if you had hydrogen fuel, you could operate a jet engine on very thin fuel-air ratios and get up to 60,000-70,000 feet. So they gave Lockheed the secret contract to develop a super U-2. They gave us contracts to develop the liquid hydrogen. And they gave Pratt & Whitney the contract to develop the engine. And we were... We're having our annual meeting. We moved from different parts of the country, and this year it's at Tampa. And we're going to start tomorrow at noon and go through noon on Sunday, so they're all busy getting things organized. So where were we now then?
We were talking about the hydrogen.
Oh, yeah. And so they gave Pratt & Whitney the contract for the engine, and we had contracts, all highly classified, for what we called the first little small unit was called Baby Bear, then there was a bigger unit called Mama Bear, and then a super unit called Papa Bear, which was hidden over in the floor of the Florida Everglades. To make then fantastic sum of amount of 30 tons per day of liquid hydrogen for this program. Well, we were going ahead full speed. Lockheed was going, Pratt & Whitney was going, and the U-2 was shot down over Russia, and Eisenhower denied it, and, you know, and then the Russians produced the pilot, and so it was an embarrassment to the United States, and the Super U-2 program was canceled. But in the meantime, engineers at Pratt & Whitney and Lockheed and elsewhere were harking back to the our earlier explorations had shown that the Germans were experimenting with liquid hydrogen rockets. They were using liquid oxygen for the bombs on Britain, but they were doing experiment on very high altitude, and it was clear from the science of rocketry that if you had liquid hydrogen for the upper stages, that you could get into orbit and put up the space station or whatever. And so that the availability of the liquid hydrogen then stimulated the R&D on liquid hydrogen rockets, and that drew us into the rocket field, and the aerospace companies did the development on the propulsion systems, but we built several large liquid hydrogen plants with government contracts in California and elsewhere, New Orleans for the testing center over here. And when we built when we started putting in the facilities to produce hydrogen at New Orleans for the government contract, and we had plants there for producing oxygen for the government contracts and nitrogen waste byproduct, hey, we got hydrogen and nitrogen, we can make ammonia. So we then went ahead and put in, and we had been building the ammonia production up till then was all based on the old Haber-Bosch mm-hmm. process with like very high pressures. But people had, Merck Cyanobit and others had developed catalysts which enabled producing, getting ammonia synthesis to go at, say, 200 or 300 pounds pressure. And we had been, as the scale of the hydrogen and oxygen plants went up in size, we had departed from the old high-pressure reciprocating compressors, which are very expensive, substituted centrifugal compressors. And so we saw a way to cut the cost of producing ammonia using some of these byproducts, running at low pressure from, I don't remember the numbers anymore, from maybe $20 a ton to $12 a ton or something like that. So we put in at New Orleans the first large-scale, low-pressure ammonia plant, and so we had a leading edge in that technology and application, but we didn't have the capacity to exploit that. We had too many other things, didn't have the people. We were growing at 15% a year compounded, and we just didn't. So others went on and developed that technology on a wide scale in the ammonia industry. But then we took the liquid hydrogen and began commercial development for selling that to the private sector, and in due course Lindy came along behind us. But we have a dominant position in that liquid hydrogen market worldwide now, and it's a big business. It's probably $1 billion worldwide in the commercial side.
When you got into a new area like liquid hydrogen, and I want to ask you about fluorine as well for the space program, you're really talking about a whole nother step in technology that you have to develop.
Yeah.
Oxygen was it, but when you get the hydrogen and fluorine, the technology
right.
has got to be
right.
quite different. How do you handle that? How do you find people who are...
Well, it was a perpetual struggle. But the people, you put your finger on the thing, that the people are the key issue. And and I recognize that. I guess from 1950 on, for 30-odd years, A year never went by when I wasn't on several college campuses lecturing to engineering and science students, and really recruiting is what it was, although we didn't call it that, and encouraging everybody else in the company to do it. Some people don't like to do that, and a lot of people don't like to do that, and it isn't easy to get a corporate body like Air Products. We had some very good active participants. Dexter was one. But many people in the company didn't like to do that, particularly the technical recruiting side. And then we had to search out some people with specific skills that we didn't have. Jim Roth was one, and Tim O'Brien was an enormously valuable. I don't know if you know about Jim Roth.
Yes, though. Yes.
And it was hard to recruit a person like Jim Roth because we didn't have a community of peers and so that was hard to do. But then he was a valuable person. Tebow retired about a year or so ago. He was 65 years old. He was a Louisiana boy, went to LSU, went to MIT and got a master's and doctor's degree in chemical engineering and was on the MIT faculty and was a consultant for us. And then finally we recruited him and induced him to come to Air Products, and he changed the nature of engineering in the company. Thibault was not a manager, but Thibault O'Brien knows and knew then the fundamental academic principles of graduate schools of chemical engineering, and he brought that know-how and then brought several others along, and so he professionalized the engineering side of the company. Nat Robertson did the same thing on the chemistry side. Nat Robertson, he retired several years ago too. He's a chemist with a PhD from Princeton, and he was in the old Spencer Chemical Company. That's where we met him, with the ammonia production, and then they were acquired by Gulf Oil, and that giant corporation with their hundreds of scientists and so forth, that didn't fit into that, and we got him to come, and he had the title for several years of Vice President of Research and Development. And Nat was like Thibault, not a manager, but rather a person who brought the understanding of the professional chemist. And it was particularly, Nat is a shy kind of person. He didn't like to go out and deal with the commercial world. But he had an innate judgment that whether this R&D effort would lead to commercial success. And so those two men played very instrumental roles in helping us professionalize those sectors.
When you're out on a college campus recruiting a young engineer just getting his degree, what do you look for? How do you tell that someone's going to fit into the culture of Air Products?
Well, I always felt, and we adhered to this, that the person with academic excellence was primary. Now, if in addition he, and they were mostly he in those days, had other campus activities, was involved in lots of things, and had leadership roles, that made it ever more attractive. And we set very rigorous standards. We didn't offer unless people were at the very top of their class. I mean, some of the practices we followed, you'd get in trouble with the EEO people about today. But that's what we did. Sorry about that.
That's right.
And the recruiting, I think it's very important to think about that. The recruiting of these really gifted people who are at the top of their class academically and had other skills and doing that year after year. If you read security analyst reports, over the years that's been frequently cited as a thing that prevented depth and breadth of management in the company. And you can see it now. Dexter ran the company after I did, and Hap Wagner does now. Those guys were products of that system, and they're surrounded by people who were counterparts of them during their same chronology.
You often, and I don't think this person would fit into what you're saying, but there are times when you're going to find someone who's quite brilliant, but prefers to be more work alone as opposed to interacting with others.
That's right, yeah.
How do you deal with that situation?
Well, a lot of those people, sometimes it doesn't work out, you know. I began this recruiting when I was still at Lawrence Tech. And the guy that was the valedictorian of our class, Arthur Harbeck, I recruited him. He came to Air Products. But he didn't stick around. He just didn't have the dynamic personality. The person who did was Jack Grafey. This is such an interesting human relations story that I ought to tell you that. When I went to Lawrence Tech, in 1939, one of the people I first encountered was this fellow, Jack Grafey. He was 6 months younger than I, something like that. And he didn't speak any English. He had just come from Germany. And his mother, they were not Jews, but his mother hated Hitler. And she smuggled this 17-year-old boy out of Germany and came to Detroit, where her brother was one of the people with Dr. Lawrence in the faculty. And so Jack was trying to go to engineering school and learn English at the same time. And I went on through and got my degree in 4 years. Took him 5 years to get his degree because he was learning English. But when about the time I came to work at Air Products, well, I got him to come to work at Air Products. And he worked part-time, and then when he got his degree, he worked full-time. And then we went to Tennessee, and we were both deferred. He had applied for and become a citizen. We were both deferred during the war. And then when the war ended, that was it as far as I was concerned. But within 2 or 3 weeks of the time the war ended, Jack was drafted. Mm. And they took him, they put him in military intelligence back in his hometown of Stuttgart, where he could talk to the Germans just like, he was a German. And so he was in the service for 2 or 3 years. And then he came to Pennsylvania, met a girl there, married, had 2 or 3 children, and had 4 children, in fact. And then the sad part was that Jack had severe arterial problems and these blood clots like Dan Quayle just had, except Jack had them in spades. And he and his wife and their small children were sent over to England. He was in charge of the engineering department in Great Britain. And he had these severe life-threatening illnesses where he'd have to go in the hospital and they'd just all this thing. And he came over here and he went to Houston to the DeBakey Center. And they told him that they had an experimental system where they could take I guess it was an artery, or maybe it's a vein, I've forgotten which, artery, I guess, and they would go into his leg where he had the thigh, where he had the most severe problems, and they put this experimental plastic tubing in there. But if he didn't do that, he stood a chance of dying, a sudden death. But because they didn't know if they would be able to do it successfully, he would, before going under the anesthesia, he would have to sign a release so that if necessary, they would amputate his leg. Well, he came up to our home in Allentown. Inez and I were there on a Saturday, and he stayed overnight, and it was a Friday night he stayed, and all day Saturday, and agonizing over this decision, and he wanted me to give him some advice, which I absolutely wouldn't do. And finally he called Gloria, his wife, in London, and asked her to take a flight to Houston. And they'd meet there Monday, and they'd go through with this. And so Saturday afternoon, I had a company car take him to Kennedy Airport for a flight to Houston. He wanted to go from Kennedy. And Monday morning, he called me, and he was back in London. He got to Kennedy, and I think that's why he wanted to go to Kennedy in the first place. Decided he didn't want to do it, called his wife, took a flight to London. Well, 6 or 7 months later, we were building a plant in Finland. And Jack was in a hospital in a hotel in Helsinki. In the middle of the night, he called the desk and said, "Send a doctor." And they sent a doctor, and he was dead. So his wife then came home. In the meantime, I told you earlier that Leonard Poole's wife had died. Gloria Grafe came home with their 4 children. And Leonard's wife had been gone for a few years. And they started dating and were married.
Mm.
They'd known each other for all these years. They were married. And they were married for 10 years or so, I guess, before Leonard died. That's how these little companies get, people get intertwined with each other.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, let me follow that for a moment. Would you say that Air Products, as it grew, had a family orientation to it?
Yeah, it doesn't have that anymore. And I didn't try to preserve that. In fact, I introduced rules that were toward professionalization. I introduced rules against the employment of relatives, of children of employees, and for example, and where if we had spouses working in a company, one didn't report to the other but worked in different departments, and movements of that kind to try because it was getting too big to operate, I thought, and I think I was right, as a family structure. It needed to have a professional management structure.
I'm going to wait till the clock finishes chiming.
Like it chimes forever.
I have clocks also, so were you instrumental in urging that the company get into chemicals?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got to the point then where we not insufficient cash flow, which we had been in the beginning, but excess cash flow. And there were several reasons for that. We had cash flow coming from these now very large government contracts where we didn't have capital investment. And we had the on-site plants had grown very large for the steel industry and the petroleum industry. And in the way we worked in those cases was we would get a 15-year contract, say, from a major steel company or a major oil company to supply a given amount of gas on a daily basis. And then we would take that contract, and in those days the credit of the steel industry and the oil industry too was so great that we could take that contract to insurance companies where we took it and get the capital for the building the plant. And whereas we could accelerated, we'd have under the Internal Revenue Service, we had an 11-year depreciation on these plants, we had a new investment tax credit at certain times, and we had a double declining balance depreciation. So we were generating far more cash than it took to pay the loan to the insurance company. So what to do with this cash? Well, there was a big hassle about that at that time. Some of the outside directors said pay the dividends to the stockholders. Others said, like this enterprise here, which was started by U.S. Steel. If you recall, in that period, there were lots of big companies, U.S. Steel and Westinghouse and others, who went into real estate development business. And we thought about, we were advocates of that. I thought that we have built up a technical capability in engineering, and the thing that's closest to what we're doing in the industrial gas, hydrogen, all those things, and we had the ammonia, we had a little toehold in ammonia, was a further movement into the chemical industry. So we started trying to do that. And we didn't have the technology. We licensed some technology from Europe. We built a plant in Delaware City to make plastics additives, licensed from Kuhlmann in Europe. Then we acquired this company here in Florida, Scambia Chemical Company. We acquired we did it mostly by acquisition, and then took these businesses that hadn't had an adequate infusion of capital, hadn't had an adequate infusion of management and technology, and we jazzed them up somewhat, and that's a very successful part of the company now.
Well, the name was changed to Air Products and Chemicals.
The name of the company, yeah, right.
And I'm not sure when that occurred.
Oh, it was probably 1960, maybe, something like that.
And acquired Hoodry at that time?
We thought Hoodry had been a part of Sun Oil Company and had done research and developed catalytic cracking and so forth. And Sun was accused of having a conflict of interest because they had their own research and Hoodry had some public shareholders, and so they wanted to sell it. We thought, that's wonderful. That's what we need, a research capability. So we bought it from them. It turned out that it was a misjudgment, although it was a marvelous misjudgment, in that Hoodry research had grown old and stale, and it really wasn't productive research. But they had all these licenses for various hydrocarbon products, the cracking technology and butadiene and other things. And in the Third World and in Asia and in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, they wanted those technologies. And that turned out to be a tremendous cash cow, where we licensed all those and got increased amounts of cash flow that we didn't anticipate. But that's the way it fell out. It was just a lucky situation.
There's a statement, this is some years later, Because I think Ted Burtis came along with Hoodry, didn't he? But then he left.
Ted came, and he was the head of Hoodry, and then he was recruited by Sun to come back and become chairman of Sun Oil.
But this statement out of thin air says the following. The decline of Dabco and of Hoodry in general was one less happy consequence of the Air Products culture. That culture was inhospitable to the style of research on which Hoodry had depended for its innovations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. The Air Products was... Well, the Hoodry people were older, for one thing, and they had... they didn't have a commercial orientation. Mr. Hoodry had run it, and the commercial approach of Hoodry was to develop some leading edge thing, which were, and they were leading edge at the time they developed them, but then license them to others, and they were those guys, and they were in their 50s, and most of us were in our 30s. It wasn't possible. The culture is a very powerful thing. Boy, I learned that in that experience, to get those folks to change. When we had a tremendous debate shortly after we acquired Hoodry, because that's when we started this plastics additives business, the oxo alcohol that I mentioned. And here's what we did. We didn't have the technology, so we licensed it from Coolmore. We didn't have the feedstock, so we made Getty Oil a joint venture to provide the feedstock. We didn't have a market, so we entered into a contract with Reichhold Chemical Company to take the output. And it was fantastic. We took the Reichhold contract to the insurance company. We got the capital on high ratio debt, and the return on the net worth that we invested there was just fabulous. Well, the Hoodry guys, when we were putting this deal together, said, we don't want to be any part of it. That won't work. You're not contributing anything. Somebody else's technology, somebody else's market, somebody else's... Yes, we're contributing. Said, we're contributing the entrepreneurship. Well, that was a foreign language. And we never... We never got together on that.
By 1973, Leonard Poole had finally turned everything over to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think he died a few years after that. But prior to that, he was still, he sort of still considered it his company, is that?
Oh yeah, and he turned his attention after his first wife's, Dorothy's, death, he turned his attention to the healthcare thing, and he, besides leaving Air Products, he left another precious heritage in the Lehigh Valley, and that's the healthcare system. Lehigh Valley Hospital is now the largest hospital in Pennsylvania. It's enormously successful, and he created all that so that the people in a community like that could have health care of the quality that she was able to get by going to Sloan Kettering Hospital. And during the past 10 or 15 years of his life, he still considered, well, I'm sure the day he died, he considered Air Products his baby. But he had made up his mind that he wanted the team, me and others, to run it, and that's the way he did. And he was in those latter years of his life doing for the hospital what he had done in early years for the company, and he ran that hospital business. Some of the people over there told me he called in the general manager one day and pointed out to him that there were squeaking doors in some of the hospital rooms.
And he was that detailed at Air Products, too,
in the
sure.
beginning,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
When was it in your career with Air Products that you finally realized that Leonard Poole had tapped you to be his successor?
Well, I don't know if it happened and I didn't have a blinding light strike me any one particular day. Dorothy played an important role in it, his first wife. She was an enormously gifted, dedicated woman. She helped him. She was Leonard was a very mercurial guy. He'd have ups and downs psychologically. And she was a very stable, steady influence. And she had a campaign going with him very early, actually. She wanted to retire, and he and she go away somewhere and relax a little. That would never have happened. That wasn't in his temperament. But she wanted him to have me take more responsibility over quite a long period of time. Now the third, I should mention this, the company really consists now of three parts, the industrial gas and the chemistry and the environmental systems. And we had never been in that, we never considered that part of our business environment. And I wasn't struck by a blinding light at any one time in regard to taking more responsibility. I do think, and I thought then looking back, that on that first Earth Day, which was probably 25 years ago, I happened to be in New York City that day, and if you recall, Fifth Avenue was closed down, and there were tens of thousands, maybe 100,000, I don't know, of people, mostly young people, sitting on Fifth Avenue in the street, singing songs about the environment and so forth. And I said, this is a movement that's got enormous force in this country. And I started, that one experience did have an impact upon me. And I started talking to our research guys and looking for ways that we could license some technology in Europe and Japan, where they'd been more advanced than we were. We developed then some biological processes which would permit use of oxygen to develop biological species which would, for tertiary cleanup of sewage. We thought that was going to be a good business, and it would have been a good business, except because what we were going to do is make a couple of them, one right here in Largo, Florida, where we would contract with the municipality on a long-term contract to treat their sewage. But then the movement had so much force that the federal government started pumping money in, and instead of the municipalities contracting with a company like us to put the capital in and perform the service, they got federal money. Mm-hmm. And the plants are run by municipalities in most cases not very well. So that business didn't turn out to have a commercial appeal, but we did others, the solid waste to energy and the scrubbers for the stack gases, and that's a third part of the company that's really got enormous prospects now.
You made an interesting comment, because when Earth Day and the concern about the environment really became obvious to the chemical industry, some industries tried to stonewall, as with Rachel Carson. I know that Ted Doan has told me at Dow that he went back and people were worried, and he said, no, we can turn this into something positive, which is exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, right.
But how did you sense your counterparts in the rest of the industry?
Yeah,
and their
reaction?
Yeah, I sensed
them like you say. But I was inspired by Ted Doan and by Gerstacker. Mm-hmm. Because they were strong advocates of exactly what you said. And then I was going around in the Chemical Manufacturers Association making speeches, and I took over the chairmanship of the Environmental Committee in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to try and bring industry around. And I was making speeches those times saying, sure, it costs a buck to improve the environment, but the buck isn't spent on the moon, it's spent here with another company. And let's find out how to take advantage of that.
When you took over in 73, in the sense that Leonard Poole had finally turned things really over to you, one of the things you did was to introduce the matrix management concept, and I'm not sure whether that came out of your Harvard Business School experience or not.
No, I don't remember ever hearing about that at Harvard Business School, but and if I were in a company today, I would abolish matrix management because you just can't do that. But it's too expensive. But in those times, we were growing so rapidly, and we had so many inexperienced people that we made mistakes, and some of them were quite costly. And so I was trying to develop a way that we could have checks and balances, and that's what we called matrix management. So we set up. It grew out of what we wanted. Leonard said, Ed Donnelly is going to be vice president and general manager. Well, what did that mean? Because we had guys like George, Carl Anderson, who was 25 years older than I, Clarence Schilling, who was one of the old stalwart people with the technical background, Frank Pavlis, old guard guys who were part of Leonard's original team. Well, I wasn't, and I was quite a lot younger than they, and I wasn't in a position to be their boss. So I began devising a structure and proposing it to Leonard and to them where those guys would continue to report directly to Leonard, not to me. That was important to them, and it was inappropriate to ask them to report to me anyway. And but then I would, if you use what's common terminology today, I'd be chief operating officer. I'd be the line officer managing the business, and they'd be staff experts giving advice to me and to other people who reported to me in their field of technical expertise. So in order to get that staff knowledge utilized, we had to have this some what we called a matrix, so that the line people would run the company, but they'd get advice and consultation from the staff people.
This must have been quite a change for a lot of people.
Yeah, it was. It was very hard to get it done. And I think it was the right thing was needed at that time, because the company didn't have the company today is entirely different. It's got people who've been in their job for 10, 20 years. In those days, we had people, you know, we grew for many years there at a compound rate of 15%. So we doubled every 5 years, doubled again and doubled again. And so we were having people do things that they didn't have any experience doing.
Several other things that happened at that time. You also stressed the role of engineering in long-term planning and the importance of that in decision-making. How did you encourage decision-making at a lower management level? Earlier everybody had gone to Leonard Poole. Now that wasn't the case anymore.
Well, I wanted engineers. You see, Carl Anderson, and I have tremendous admiration for Carl Anderson. He is a person of enormous integrity, and there was in an organization where Anderson was present, his moral authority was so high that there would never be any corner cutting. And that was a contribution of morality, integrity that he brought to the corporation as it grew. That was his strength. What I guess I would maybe call it a weakness, in that Anderson never, he said, he always said, he said it over and over, he's an engineer. Management has to tell us what to engineer, and then we'll engineer it. And I didn't think that was the right thing to do. I thought the engineer should be part of management. The other people should be part of management. The finance professionals should be part of management, and so forth. And so it was that kind of old-style authoritarian direction from the top that I thought was ought to be broken down, and that was what I was trying to do. Without ever being offended, I never would have said anything derogatory to or about Carl Anderson.
Another thing that you encouraged at that time was combining an MBA degree with an engineering degree.
Yeah, well, part of the same syndrome, I think, yeah. A lot of those MBA guys have done enormously well in the company. The management nowadays is really, MBAs are unfashionable today, but that whole top management group now are guys with engineering and MBA degrees.
I don't remember at that particular time whether that was unusual. Were you one of the leaders in that movement of combining a technical degree with an MBA?
I don't think too much. I think there was a time when it was very popular. I think though that we were able to bring in, there was a lot of competition for MBAs in those days because it was so popular and fashionable. But a lot went to Wall Street, a lot went into consulting firms and got enormous salaries, and it was hard for manufacturing companies to attract them, but we had an advantage that many manufacturing companies didn't have, and that we were growing so rapidly. This company is size X now, but in 5 years it's going to be 2X, and in 10 years it's going to be 4X, and so it was enabled us to recruit not just MBAs, but the top people in all categories.
You had plenty of opportunities to offer people.
Yeah, yes. Right. And we had the image. We were perceived as being having opportunity.
You also brought back something that Leonard Poole had introduced earlier called the Career Development Program.
Yeah. Yeah, we did that. We always did that. And the essence of it was that we recognized always that there are some professionals in science or engineering or accounting or tax policy or whatever, some people, law, some people may have a certain discipline, professional discipline that they want to follow, and that's their career objective. But for someone who's going to be a general officer of the company, chairman, president, vice president, or whatever, they will be able to do those jobs more effectively if they have diversified experience. So we used to have what we called double diamond charts. They would chart the theoretical progression of a person through his career. And if he went straight through without taking these diversified experiences on a double diamond, he wouldn't be as well equipped at age 45 or whatever to take on more responsibility. So we had we put it all eventually on computers. If a person worked for 5 years in a given discipline with no diversified experience, that printed up on a computer program, and his supervisor had to say why that was so. We recognize it may be very legitimate, mm-hmm. may be the right mm-hmm. thing for that person, mm-hmm. but we don't want to let people drift into not having diversified experience. That's what that was basically all about. And it's done yet today. It sort of became embedded in the... I haven't talked to Happ or those guys about it lately, but it's kind of embedded in the culture of the company.
Let me just change the tape now. I know that you had...
ran into some safety problems. And at one point, you really tried to turn the whole thing around, and the safety had declined within the company. And you
yeah. I don't know if it had declined. I think we deluded ourselves. We paid lip service to safety, and we really believed that we had a safe program. But then and Thibault brought this. Thibault made it possible to do this. I said, Thibault, I want to see the measured statistics of how good our safety record is and how we compare it to other companies. And he got from various sources, and we really got out on the table the facts about safety, which we always said we were good at, and the facts showed we weren't. And so we then moved it very high on the priority, the management of the company, and I set up a system where we had a management committee meeting every Monday morning. And the first thing on the management committee was to be the safety performance. And we put it right up on the board in the various departments and the divisions of what the safety record was. And then managers who had been kidding themselves that safety is pretty good, the camouflage was stripped away, and it got to be very good. We have one of the best records in the world now.
If I remember correctly, you worked with DuPont or used the DuPont system.
We brought DuPont in as a consultant. That's correct. Yeah. All right.
Because they've had a long-standing reputation in the industry
for being extremely safety conscious. What we had to do was raise the consciousness of the managers and of the people at all levels about the importance of this, and that's what the system did.
Mm-hmm. You brought in Dexter Baker. I don't remember when now, but you I think originally hired him, didn't you?
I think so. My memory is not absolutely certain about that. Dexter had a degree in engineering from Lehigh, and he had a good, a really good commercial sense from the very beginning, and he was, when we were growing very rapidly here, and we were growing very rapidly in Europe, and we didn't have adequate management capacity in Europe. And then it was decided that although we needed Dexter badly here, that we needed somebody really strong over there. So we sent him over, and Dexter stayed there for 10 or 12 years and really created Air Products Europe from a little small thing to parallel the American experience.
In 68, he became executive vice president, I believe. And around that time, you hired Dick Fleming to run the chemicals business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which you then reorganized about 7 years later. And Fleming left.
Yeah. Well, what was going on then is that the main body of the chemical group grew out of the Hoodry acquisition. It was located in Philadelphia. And Dick Fleming, who is a very strong man, he is a strong, strong person. He wanted to build his own company. He wanted it to be, he was owned by Air Products, but if Dick could have seen a way to have it owned by somebody else and be really independent, he would have liked to have done that. And so it was emerging then that there was really a competitive rivalry, which is a good thing and to a certain degree, but this became too competitive. And I concluded that unless the company, specific effort was made to bring the company into one unified company with the operating groups, that it would fracture. And so we moved the chemical group headquarters from Philadelphia to Allentown, and that melding process went forward from that time. Dick wasn't satisfied about it, and he, in due course, left.
You've always been and always have emphasized not only your own personal aspects, but the company as well, the relationship to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And
I've got it. I don't know. Did Bonnie or anybody send you? I got this for you. Here they just wrote an article in the news. Have you seen that?
No.
Take it with you. That's a Xerox copy of an article that the Allentown newspaper ran a month or so ago, telling what I've done since I retired with this education reform business. So this is a post-retirement extension of what I always thought should be the role of the corporate executive and the corporation in the community.
Before you retired, as you were approaching retirement, there's one other thing I wanted to mention that is before that, and that is the Corporate Science Center.
Mm-hmm.
Which was started around 1980, I believe.
That's when we got Jim.
Yeah. What was the background?
Well, we were really, as the company grew, when we started out, there were no real professional disciplines there. Everybody did everything, and Leonard decided what they should do. But then, as it became bigger, we had to have a degree of discipline based on a segmentation of skills, and the professionalization of the various skills took place at different times, depending on what the needs of the company were. I'd say the first thing that achieved professional stature, the first discipline, was sales and marketing, and then engineering. Finance came later. Research came toward the end. We didn't really have a professional research function. But as I said earlier, Nat Robertson brought us the know-how about how to do that, and Nat recruited Jim Roth and others with the professional skill of Jim Roth. And Bob Lovett then, and Brian Rushton, those were some of the stars that grew out of the Robertson heritage. And the creation of the Science Center was an attempt to really create a world-class professional research capability.
Just before retirement, you essentially cleaned house a little bit.
Yeah.
What was your thinking?
Well, we had accumulated a lot of. We were entrepreneurs. We'd created a lot of entrepreneurial activity. Not all of it was successful. Some was, some wasn't, some was marginal. And I felt that, as I approached retirement, that it would be statesmanlike, really, I thought, and my responsibility to hand my successors a clean operation. And if I'd been 10 years younger and were going to have the job for another 10 years, I think some of those things could have been cleaned up and improved. But I didn't want to leave that hanging there, so I decided that it would be preferable, and I recommended to the board, and they agreed, that we take and clean house, as I think what you said, and to give a, so that my successor, Dexter, would inherit a rock-hard balance sheet with no soft assets in it. And so we took those steps and did it. And I'm glad that we did. I've seen other companies that didn't do it. The Borden case comes to mind as a sad case where those managers should have cleaned up a number of those things, not let them linger. And there are many others you can point out.
Is that, well, if you're going to be an entrepreneur and you need to take risks somewhere along the line, and you commented about that, I think, in your address to the chemical industry at the time of your award, you talked about risk-taking, and but you also at that point seemed somewhat pessimistic about the future. And
I don't remember if I was pessimistic or why I should have been. I don't know.
Well, I'm quoting here, the future of our way of life is at stake.
Basically, I'm even now yet today, I'm optimistic that we're going to solve our problems, but we've got real big problems. And I think that this, we've got this new political system here in both our state and our country. I don't think we're dealing with the correct issues, though. The issue, education, I'm committed to that. It's hard to fix. We're making slow, agonizing progress, but it's going to take decades to fix the K-12 education system in this country. But underlying it all, in my view, and hardly anybody says this, is that we're not investing in the United States enough capital. Capital no longer has any nationality. It's a world commodity. And over 20 years now, the rate of new capital investment as a percent of gross national product in Asia is double the United States, and in Europe it's half again as high as the United States. And we see declining middle class incomes, we see middle class tax cuts, we see battles about health care and so forth. Fundamentally, we're not creating wealth at a rapid enough rate. And our whole economy is directed toward consumption. Our government is directed toward consumption rather than capital formation. And that's a tough issue, but eventually we have to deal with that. I am optimistic that we will, but I'm pessimistic about how long it's taking us to recognize it. There are a few people in the industry. Peterson is talking about that, and there's a group... Not what they call themselves now. Did Ralph Landau ever receive this SCI award?
Perkin Medal.
The Perkin Medal.
Mm-hmm.
He's connected with a group who's advocating capital formation. I think they're right on target. But Gingrich is not talking about it, and Clinton is sure as hell not talking about it.
How do the new trade agreements affect the chemical industry?
Well, they're good. They're good. As you know, the chemical industry has always had a positive balance of payments, and so whatever fosters easier world trade is good for the chemical industry, and I think it's good for the country, although, of course, there are, up in the area where we live, the remnants of the textile workers are going to be, they're going to be out of work. I went over here just, I don't want to delay, but Inez and I were over here in the shopping mall just before Christmas, and I went through some of those shops, you know, children's clothing and so forth, and I looked and I looked and I looked and I looked, and I couldn't find anything that had a USA label on it. Hong Kong, Singapore, Romania, you name it.
Well, the Wilkes-Barre area had a big garment base at one time,
yeah,
and that's
mm-hmm.
all. When I went there, it was a big base,
yeah.
And now it's all disappeared.
Yeah.
Let me just turn to some of the questions on this sheet that I sent you. We've covered a number of these already. The innovation, what does scientific innovation mean to you is derived from your experiences?
Now, we practiced our careers in a different time than it is today. We were working in the field of more or less engineering innovation. We wouldn't have invented a computer chip or a transistor or some a real breakthrough science thing. We were pushing back the margins from an engineering standpoint, and if we hadn't done that, we wouldn't have been successful. I mean, like that guy in Rochester says, if you always do what you always did, you always get what you always got. So it's the heartbeat of what makes success. But to get it, you got to have the people.
Do you think that it's the economics that drives innovation?
Sure. Yeah. We're in it. The people are in it for the money, but that's a simplistic answer. I think it's fair to say that making money wasn't a motivating driving factor to me as a person. It sure wasn't to Leonard Poole. I mean, the money was sort of an afterthought. I think that the biggest driving force is some innate thing that exists in the human spirit.
Okay. Changes in management agendas during your long career as a manager.
Well, certainly the management agenda has changed to be more less authoritarian than it was. When I look back, and in the old, when I was young and Air Products were young, but we were doing with older companies like the steel industry, for example, there was a top-down authoritarian management structure. The boss was driven to work in a limousine in the morning, and there, those artifacts of authority were made very prominent. Those days are gone. We're a far more egalitarian society, and there's strength in that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've talked about public issues such as environmental concerns. A little bit about government relations, and I believe I remember reading somewhere that you were concerned about over-regulation on the part of the federal government.
Oh, I think it's far too much, and I think we're seeing a backlash against it now. That's what the election was a major factor in, and we're going to see a substantial curtailment. When I chaired the Environmental Committee in the U.S. Chamber, I advocated to, what was her name, that woman from South North Carolina who was Secretary of Commerce. I advocated that we exercise a cost-benefit ratio analysis on all new environmental regulations, and that was considered anathema in those times in the Carter administration. But now Gingrich and these guys are advocating that, and the EPA man is under attack. So we're going to have to examine the cost of government regulations much more carefully than did in the past. It's growing too big. I'm convinced of that. And it's soaking up capital. And government can't make the judgments on how best to deploy capital. You have to get government out to a greater extent.
I remember someone telling me that his father had started the company, and at one point when his father was in his late 80s, he went to an affair where there were a number of people, and he said, "Who are all these people?" His son said, "Well, they're the lawyers and they're the environmental people." He said, "But they're not selling anything."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And here you have now this large group of employees,
yeah,
and operations that,
yeah, right,
are virtually non-productive. And
that's right. Well, our two sons are lawyers, and they're part of their generation. As you know, we graduate twice as many lawyers here as they do in Japan on a per capita basis, and half as many engineers. And incidentally, we made an analysis, and I sent this to Ralph Landau, if you raise the rate of new capital investment in the United States to the level it is in Japan, and we know the percent of capital that has to go into designing the machinery and all everything, presto, we would have to graduate twice as many engineers as we do. Presto, if engineering became the field to study, there'd be less guys going to law school, less people going to law school. So the allocation of capital, I'm convinced, affects the basic social structure of the of the society.
Well, in the 30s and 40s, the science and engineering was the was going to really everybody was looking at it as being the savior of coming out of the war and the depression, and now we had all of these great opportunities thanks to science and engineering. And now,
yeah,
chemistry is a dirty word, and
yeah,
very few companies are left that still have the word chemical in the name.
Yeah, right. An analyst told me once, so you get another 2 points in the P.E. ratio if you change your name back to Air Products.
That's interesting. Well, I know Dow was, there was at one point a suggestion that Dow would drop the word chemical, but that didn't happen. There were a number of people who were adamant that they were going to keep it as the Dow Chemical Company. But DuPont has changed. DuPont dropped it, and I think Monsanto dropped it, and others as well. Well, we're approaching 11 o'clock, so I think at this point
it's been very
close, and thank you for
talk to you, and I thank you for coming. If you think about this and anything comes up you want to talk about further, why, just call me.
Okay. All right. Maybe we'll do that. I appreciate the time you spent this morning.
Okay. I'm glad to do it.